Coming to you from Orange County, California, this is the Jug Life Podcast with Max Ada and Chad Wesley Smith.
Hey everybody, what is up? Chad Wesley Smith here, bringing you another episode of the Jug Life Podcast. I'm joined, as always, by Miraculous Max Montana. How you doing, buddy?
Doing pretty well. How about you guys?
Good, good. And our guest today, from Renaissance Periodization, Dr. James Hoffman.
Hey, guys. Glad to be here. This is fun.
Well, we've only just begun.
The fun is just starting.
The Hoffmaniac.
Yes, Hoffmania running wild. I'm going to rip my shirt off.
What you going to do when Hoffmania runs wild on you? All right, so if you are not familiar with Dr. Hoffman, PhD, sport physiology from TSU.
Exactly.
A now former professor of...
Former professor. Actually, I was former program director. Okay. I was a head honcho for a little while.
Well, then. Wow.
Yeah.
How much did you bitch Mike around when you were...
I tried to like be easygoing, but yeah, there was some whip cracking that went around.
It was mostly for
students, which is a pain in the butt, you know?
Yeah.
Whip cracking on the students?
Yeah, they're like, I don't want to take swimming. And you're like, too bad. Get in the pool.
And then your sport background and more of your coaching background comes from rugby, right?
Predominantly, yeah, rugby. Yeah. I've done wrestling for a long time. I did a little bit of basketball. I did football. But most of it was rugby. And I've gotten into kickboxing lately, which has been really fun.
Okay. And now you're just a recent... migrant here to Southern California.
That's right.
So welcome.
Moved from Philly. Brought my cat on the plane, which was great. He vomited and pooped in his carrier. So that was, you know.
At least it wasn't outside of his carrier.
Yeah. I was sitting in the baggage claim and Mel was handing me poop. Like, you know, we're waiting for our bags and I'm sitting there with a big pile of poop. She's like, oh, there's more. And I'm like, I look really cool right now.
Yeah. The things you do for the animals.
He cried for the whole flight. 6 hours.
Well, shit.
And what we're going to be talking about today are recovery adaptive strategies. And I guess we'll say this is a bit of a specialty for you. And you're currently authoring a book or have authored and it's being edited.
Yeah, being edited. I don't even know how it became a specialty for me. I did a bunch of other weird stuff when I studied. And then the recovery strategies just kind of was something I was pursuing in my free time. Just like, oh, this is cool. This is interesting. Or this doesn't make any sense. And then somehow I became like the de facto recovery guy, which is kind of weird. But I like it. It's really fun. It's a great area of study, and we're putting out a book on it. It should be pretty good.
Do you know what the title of that book is yet?
I have the title, but I honestly forgot off the top of my head. So it's something to the tune of like recovering from training. I think the science and practice of fatigue management or something similar to that. We were going back and forth on the title for a while.
Yeah, Nick had messaged me about that. I figure in the vein of current RP titles, it's probably called How Much Should I Recover?
Yeah, the original thought was just recovery book, and you know, like the other one's like training book, diet book, but we're trying to spice it up a little bit, expand our vernacular.
All right, so before we get into recovery adaptive strategy with James, we're going to take a quick break for a strength history minute, this time covering Jeff Capes. But actually, you would kind of look like if you were much bigger.
Way more jacked.
Yeah, if you were like a...
If I was way more jacked, so that was a neg on me. Oh.
Yeah, if you were like 150 pounds heavier.
So, not even close, but...
Well, I'm talking more on the hair beard situation is a bit Capesian, but yeah. So let's take a minute, get to know Jeff Capes, and then we're back with Dr. James.
Jeff Capes is a multi-talented strength athlete, succeeding across varied disciplines, including being a three-time Olympian in the shot put representing Great Britain, two-time World's Strongest Man, and a six-time Highland Games World Champion. Standing 6'5", weighing 375 pounds, that's 27 stones for our British friends, or about 170 kilos, Capes held a PR of 21.68 meters, 71 feet, 3.5 inches in the shot put. That was the British record that stood for 23 years. He was also a two-time Commonwealth Champion. He was a 1983 and 1985 World's Strongest Man, as well as taking second in 81 and 86 and third in 80 and 84. As a six-time Highland Games World Champion, he held multiple world records. He claims PRs in the lifts of 380 kilos in the squat, 300 kilo bench press, which was most likely a bounce done in a more shot-putting style, and 454.5 kilos, 1,000 pounds, in the deadlift from 18 inches.
All right, so we are back with Dr. James Hoffman, Renaissance Periodization, author of a book about recovery.
I think that's actually a good title, a book about recovery.
Make a note. The James Hoffman story.
Oh. So as we get into this, I think the first thing that's important for people to understand is, you know, the term recovery is just sort of like everyone says it, but what does it actually mean to recover from training?
So when we're talking about it from training, the first point of confusion I think people make is recovery from injury. That's usually the first one, and it's an easy one to mistake. So usually when you say recovery, people kind of think of that as being synonymous with recovering from injury and recovering from training. So one of the things that we like to say is, hey, we're actually talking about it in a specific context of I did some hard training, and now I'm looking at strategies to not only get bigger, faster, stronger, but also make sure that I am recovering adequately between sessions or week to week or even month to month, year to year. And that could be independent of injury. And when we're talking about recovery from training, really what we're looking at is kind of, I would say, two to threefold. One is kind of the obvious and the kind of the classic biological medical definition where we encountered some stressor, right? And we're essentially trying to get back to normal. We're going from our normal resting state, we have a stressor, which decreases our performance for at least a little while, and we're trying to get back to normal, right? So that's kind of the first part. The second part is, well, you know, we don't just train to be what we were on Tuesday, we're trying to get better. So we're trying to think of strategies that allow us to train really hard and then promote that recovery and actually go above our baseline and get better than we were before, right? So there's things that we're factoring in there. And then part three is kind of another misconception where we're saying you don't actually have to be fully recovered if you want to train again. Recovery is kind of a spectrum of states where we have an acceptable amount of fatigue that we're carrying around with from training, but we can still train hard. So really when we're talking about recovery from training, we're talking about the period in which you can do overload training again, not necessarily 100% athlete preparedness, like competition style athlete preparedness, which is an entirely different thing. So there's kind of like that spectrum where some people think, I have to be fully recovered. I can't have any soreness, any stiffness going into my next session. And that's probably holding them back a little bit. You can carry around a little bit of fatigue. The question is like how much? And that's really when we start getting into the issue of recovery. So that's usually how I like to think about it.
And yeah, sort of the second part of it, and it, I mean, you started talking about it, but is there important things to differentiate between recovery and adaptation?
They're both kind of an interlinked process, right? So when we're dealing with strategies that are specific for recovery, we might only be looking at our ability to kind of get back to normal. Whereas other strategies we might adopt might include that, but also include elements of going above and beyond. So a really common example that we see all the time in the recovery strategy stuff is the use of things like ice, heat, compression, right? That's a really good contrast in this idea in that those things can actually help promote recovery really, really well. They can help you get back on your feet really, really fast, but they do come at a little bit of a cost. So that might be a strategy that favors recovery over adaptation, whereas something like getting enough sleep, eating enough food gives you the same benefits of recovery, but don't really come at any cost and can help you drive the adaptive processes. So there are some that like we can implement a little bit more strategically, which is kind of where we differentiate recovery and adaptation.
When you mention at a cost, you're referring to interfering with the adaptation process?
Yes. Right. So some of them can interfere a little bit with how much gains you make. And so this also gets blown out of proportion a lot. And sometimes I'm guilty of that, maybe not explaining that to the best of my ability. But yeah, so like, for example, if you went and did like 5x10 squats or deadlifts or something, you're going to be really beat up and your knees are going to be sore, your back and hips might be sore. One thing that a lot of people do is they'll jump in the ice bath because it makes them feel better, right? And rightfully so, it actually does help speed up how quickly they can get back on their feet and go into their next really hard training session. The problem is that it does start to reduce the inflammation that they get from that training session, which does tend to ever so slightly blunt some of the strength or muscle mass that they would have potentially gained. It's only a little bit, and oftentimes it's, if you look at studies, it's not even statistically significant, but there's a clear trend where it's like, okay, no modality, I get this much. Regular training plus modality, I get this much. And like, there's just a little sliver of difference there, which acutely is probably not a big deal. But in the long term, if you're chronically overusing those things, it could start shaving off, you know, big gains in the long, like 10 years from now.
Yeah, that's when that topic comes up a lot in my seminars. Tell them, you know, during the course of regular training, it's probably best to be avoided during a deload week or something, go for it. But if the option is, you know, I either take this ice bath so I can do the next session, or I skip the next session, or I do the next session within reasonable overload parameters, then yeah, take the ice bath. But if people are getting into every time I squat, I take an ice bath right after, yeah, that's where we're going to run into issues.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because that's usually the big, that's like the prerequisite problem that people run into, whereas they do a bunch of stupid crap in their training or in their lifestyle, and then they're trying to say, like, what can I do to put a Band-Aid on this so I can get back to it? But what's the problem? If you can't get to your next training session without taking an ice bath, what's the underlying problem? Well, you're probably chronically, either acutely or chronically, overreaching all the time. You're probably actually doing too much or training outside of your means. So that's one of the reasons why we put out like the volume book, because we were trying to illustrate, hey, there is a limit to how much training you can do. And in the recovery book, we say, even if you're doing that, if you are exceeding the amount of training that you can tolerate, there's no fancy drink, there's no hot bath, there's nothing that can fix that. Once you go above and beyond kind of your, what we call your maximum recoverable volume, recovery strategies are insufficiently powerful to ameliorate that. So you got to be training within your means. That's
a problem I see that could be linked with that as well, is that people fail to understand that fatigue and feeling bad is actually a necessary part of training. I've see this a bit more and more, maybe with the increase in proliferance of tracking systems, and I'll talk to you more about this as a bit of technology and training. But if a coach has access to an Omega Wave, you know, that, and let's say it's giving them green, you know, yellow or red, they're trying to keep them green all the time, and it's like, no, there should be a lot of yellow involved, and maybe
yes,
and occasional red.
Damn it.
Yeah, and occasional, yes, reds as well, because if it's green, you're always feel good. How are you driving any adaptation with that?
Exactly. So I like to think of it as kind of like an acceptable amount of attrition that you would experience throughout a mesocycle or an annual plan, right? So you know there are times throughout the year where you're going to be jacked up, right? You might be in like a GPP phase where you're doing high reps, or you might be really hitting, like if you're doing, if you're a rugby player, if you're doing a lot of tactics and like scrimmaging a lot, like, yeah, there are going to be days where we expect you to not be at your best. That is a strategic and calculated move to potentiate gains in the long term. So we have basically what you're kind of suggesting is an overemphasized fatigue management system, right? Where it's like you're favoring fatigue management over generating big overloads, right? So the question becomes like, how do I use all those cool tools? Because what we don't want to say is that those tools are useless. They actually probably are very, very useful. You can use things like bar speeds, like the Omega Waves, all the different, there's like $20,000 to $30,000 software you can get for athletes that does all these different questionnaires and integrates them into this thing. You can use GPS. There's all sorts of cool toys out
HRV.
There. HRV. But the problem that we run into is usually all of those things by themselves, I don't want to say are meaningless, but can only suggest that something is there. And what I like to tell people when we talk about fatigue management and recovery is you probably need at least three things. And the three things that I usually recommend is a performance measure. So you have to show me that performance in some way, whether it's your lifting, how fast you run, the number of efforts you made in a practice session, your performance has to go down, right? That has to be clear. There's some amount of performance that's going down. Two, I like to see some type of physiological measurement that indicates something's weird, like heart rate or like a morning heart rate, or you can do like blood, TC, and that's not widely available. But if you have a laboratory, you can do that, testosterone, cortisol measurements. Anything along those lines, some type of physiological marker that says this is outside of its normal boundary. And then a psychological marker, a perceptive marker, which says, you know, like Johnny Boy reports, he's been really anxious. His world seems to be collapsing around him. Now I have three things. Like his performance was down. There's some measurable variable that I found that said like, okay, we're indicating a really catabolic or fatigued state. And he's expressing signs and symptoms that he's beginning to be overreached or over-fatigued. Now I can say something is pretty definitively wrong. But if I just use something like a bar tracking speed, right? Is if they have a couple bad days, is it because they're overreached and they're supposed to be overreached? Is it because they just didn't give a shit that day and just were kind of dogging it, right? Or is it because they're really fatigued? I don't know. There's not enough information there.
And you and Mike, right, just you several years ago wrote a very, very good article on our site called like Fatigue Indicators and How to Utilize Them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And in it, you differentiate between, I believe, a lagging indicator and a leading indicator. Can you kind of expand on that idea?
Yeah. So one of the things that we like to reiterate is we have a lot of like cool quantitative and qualitative tools to monitor fatigue and recovery. And as a sports scientist, like our job is to know how to collect that data and hopefully make meaningful changes to the training plan. Along with that, we have a time scale. We have things that are leading indicators, concurrent indicators, and lagging indicators. So the leading indicator is something that is kind of predictive, where it's saying, hey, something might be coming up in the next couple days, right? Something might be a little bit off. And we can look at something like what was the athlete's workload, either in training or if they maybe they had to help their uncle in their landscaping business the day before. We know that, okay, if I go out and shovel a bunch of gravel, or you know what's really heavy, deceivingly heavy, is leveling sand. My God, it doesn't look like it, but it's really heavy. So if I go out and do a bunch of leveling sand with my uncle's business, you know, the next day there's no way I can hit a big pole because my back and I'm just going to be fatigued, right? So that might be a leading indicator where he said, okay, something happened and I'm expecting there to be a change. Or maybe they didn't eat as much as they're supposed to the next day. So a leading indicator is something where we're saying, hey, might not be a problem right now, but it might be a problem within the next few days or within like a week or so. So we're kind of expecting a problem to come up. A concurrent indicator is something where we're actually evaluating the athlete in their current state, where I'm looking at myself or you guys and I say, you know what? I've measured something that indicates right now something's maybe not quite right, where I might have like a heart rate measurement that's kind of funky. I can even have a performance measurement that's really funky, like maybe you missed a lift at the meet or you bombed out, something like that. That would be a pretty clear indicator that something wasn't right, and that's happening right now. So we might choose to act on that. And then a lagging indicator is kind of something that is indicative of a fatigue state when it's kind of too late. So it's something that has already manifested and it's already present. And there are some things like heart rate variability and some other things that kind of show up later and can kind of confirm like, yeah, Chad pushed it too far, but by the time that you get a measurement on that, it's kind of too late and you have to do damage control versus managing it at the right time.
So I think, you know, as a the coach's job or the athlete's job, if they're handling their own programming, in using lagging indicators, a tool like HRV, which, you know, a lot of people are very, you know, big proponents of their use, it's the first time it's a lagging indicator. And then the coaches who can successfully take that data and take the information from seeing, well, what did we do to cause this dip in HRV? Right. So the next time I can turn it into a leading indicator and, you know, put the deload week or light session at the appropriate time.
Absolutely. And that's a really good example of individualization for the coach. So you can say like, I have a trend analysis. So I saw what happened last time. I saw what their heart rate started to do. And I know exactly what we did in training. And now we can start putting those things together and say, okay, I probably overstepped their training a little bit. I can back down or maybe adjust accordingly. And if I see this same heart rate trend, whether it's a morning heart rate or heart rate variability or whatever, I already know that I'm kind of going in that direction. So I can take steps to ameliorate some of those things at the current time. So, I mean, like, it's not to, so like sometimes we look at the lagging indicators as this like, I don't want to say useless, but some people will be like, well, what's the point of measuring something that like when it's already too late? Mm-hmm. That's useful information later down the road, right? It might not be useful right now because the person's already gone above like their MRV or they're already just too fatigued or maybe they got sick or injured. It's too late. But you go back and look at what you did before you got to that point, and that becomes extremely useful. That's what evidence-based practice, in my opinion, is, right? You have research that says, hey, you should be thinking about using these things. We've done studies. They're well correlated. There's lots of data to support it. You say, okay, I'm going to start using that. Then when you start using it, you collect your own data, and you say, like, okay, well, I saw what happened to Chad when I implemented this into the program, and now I have this data. So now you have scientific data and your own anecdote or your own collected data, boom, you put them together, that's evidence-based practice. So I think that's a really good example of like what evidence-based practitioners should be doing in the field, not just saying like science only or coaching only, you know, it's like put them together.
Yeah, and some of that's a discussion for a different day probably, but I think there's almost, the pendulum has swung too far for a lot of people towards just evidence-based practice and discounting coaches' observations.
Oh yeah.
Who maybe aren't going to ever write a, you know, peer-reviewed journal article about things, but that doesn't mean that what they're seeing isn't real.
Yeah, it goes both ways. So like there was like, I don't want to name any names, but there was a few people who were very like anti-science in the last couple of years. Luckily, they have calmed down on social media. And there are people that go the other way that say like all coaches are stupid and uneducated. And it's like, well, both probably have really useful things to say. Like the best coaches are the ones who can take both of those things and synthesize it for their individual athletes.
So as we're looking at these different recovery adaptive strategies, and that's just basically ways to improve the recovery adaptive process. What is one thing maybe that you see as actually being a negative that athletes out there are doing, and it's in fact taking away from their recovery?
Oh man, where do we start? There's so many things. So I think there's a thought process that needs to be fixed before we even get into like, what are they actually doing, right? The thought process is usually one that says, I'm training, I need to recover better. I need to add something, right? I need to add something on top of what I'm doing. Give me the fancy drink. Give me the weird therapy treatment. Give me this and that. Let me start doing more things. When in reality, what you probably need to do is evaluate what you're doing in your lifestyle and how that actually meets the rigors of training. You're probably not doing or you're probably overdoing in some cases a lot of things, like maybe training too much, not sleeping enough, not relaxing enough. And I think we have this mentality
lack of compassionate touching.
That goes a long way. And it sounds silly, but that might be something. And that's kind of, it's like there's clearly a hierarchy of things that are important, and maybe compassionate touching is not on the top of the list, but it's one of those things like, you know, maybe it is on the top of the list, and that's awesome. High five. But it's certainly something that...
It's more of a low five.
It's certainly something that could help, right? And it's like, I think there's this thought process of like, I need to add stuff, but it's like the best recovery strategies are things that you probably already are doing and you just haven't paid attention to. You haven't thought about it enough. You haven't really looked into it. You know, like stuff like compassionate touch. Like if you have a significant other, and it doesn't have to be like a weird sex thing. It can be like just pleasant interactions with friends and family. Like it doesn't have to be like...
Where did the sex part come?
It's always like has this creepy connotation where it's like, whoa, compassionate touch, right?
Just
it's
a
like,
couple of guys compassionately touching each other.
Just hanging out, you know, like, Chad, I think you look really nice today, you know, something like that.
What do you think Max and I have been doing under the table for the last 20 minutes?
The table's kind of dipped down a little bit.
hands up here. All hands on deck.
So I think it's this, first it's like this mindset of like, I need to add stuff, when in reality it's like, maybe you need to actually reevaluate what you're already doing, right? So a couple things that are generally negative that I see a lot is excessive heat use is one that like is just kills me. And I become more sympathetic to it. I used to think it was just totally stupid. But what we have found is that a little bit of heat exposure, and especially if you do like contrast, like cold and heat, but a little bit of heat exposure can be useful. But it's on the scale of like 20 to 30 minutes. Once you start doing like really, really hot environments like a steam room, Southern California, it was like 95 the other day. I'm from the Midwest. It's supposed to be like zero right now. It's throwing me off. If you're in really hot environments like the sauna, the steam room, for more than like 45 minutes to an hour, you really stop benefiting from that acute heat exposure. You stop reaping the benefits, and then you actually start adding stressors, right? So
when you've begun the weight cutting process.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So like, you know, most of us are familiar with football. Like in the summer, it's not uncommon for high school and middle school teams to be out there doing doubles or even triples, like out in July and August, right? What happens to those kids? A bunch of them drop dead each year, or they have to get rushed off due to heat illness, right? What do you think is happening when they're doing that? Is that supposed to be positive or good? No, it's terrible. So heat is a stressor. In small doses, it can be useful. But once you kind of are in like the 45 minutes to an hour of being in a really hot environment, you start adding heat stress, which can lead to heat illness, and you start getting dehydrated, right? And we've already seen like dehydration, if you lose like 1 to 2% of your body weight in water loss, performance starts to go down and across the board. So
I would imagine an actual like designed heat environment, like a steam bath or a steam room or a sauna or something, the time frame would be even much shorter than that, maybe more like 10 to 15 minutes.
It's intense. Yeah. It's like very hot, very humid. I would say like even just like a warm bath is probably good enough, yeah. Right? You don't need to be doing this like crazy stuff. Can you imagine if somebody made, you know how they have like the cryo tubes now, which I think is cool, but can you imagine if they made like a heat blaster tube where it was like a, basically like a hair dryer that you got into, like that would be terrible. People would just die.
Yeah.
Right.
Just stick your head in the oven.
it's called the rotisserie.
Exactly. Convection. It's like the air fryer, but for your body.
I would imagine too that that any recovery benefit that the heat has, you know, I hear people talk about like getting the synovial fluid moving or anything, but I would imagine it's more of just like a relaxation psychological benefit.
You just opened up a big can of worms. So like the heat, there's conflicting evidence on heat. I think there is a trend that generally suggests that it is good and it can promote like blood flow. What I have been saying, and is part of the recovery book too, whatever the title ends up being, is a lot of that is confounded just by relaxation. Relaxation is probably one of the most important things that you can do for yourself. And a lot of these other kind of funky recovery modalities just end up kind of indirectly promoting relaxation. So like when you get into a nice warm bath or like a hot tub, what's the first thing you do? You're like, oh man, this feels good. And you just, you're in that low gravity environment. You just relax and you forget about whatever shit was going on earlier in the day.
Maybe a little compassionate touch.
Maybe a little compassionate touch. If you don't get too hot, sometimes I get too hot and I'm like, oof, no, can't. but it's too hot. I can't. I think, and this is just my, you know, it's not even a hypothesis really. It's just, I suspect, and there's no way to prove at the current time this thought, but a lot of the things that we do are just ways of promoting relaxation, and relaxation seems to be one of the most powerful underlying principles of recovery that there is. Relaxation is to the daytime what sleeping is to the nighttime, right? It's one of our big autonomic regulators managing things like our hormonal balance of anabolic, catabolic, our nervous system balance of sympathetic, parasympathetic. It's so important. And like you said, like, well, what's the difference between taking a hot bath or just taking time on the couch and hanging out with your kitty? I would say there might be a slight advantage to doing the hot bath. There might be some blood flow stuff there, but it's probably a lot of relaxation.
And probably a lot of it is almost just what the person prefers.
Yeah.
Particularly with a lot of the soft tissue therapies, I think, and maybe you get into those a bit, where the research upon there, you know, like Quinn will talk about if a foam roller was actually going to induce change in the tissue, that it would have to be some, yeah, don't quote me on the numbers, but like 1500 pounds of force or something.
It's
like
absurd.
That. And so that it's not, you know, whether it's that or dry needling or active release or Graston or whatever, that it's not affecting a physical muscular change the way that people think it is. But if they think that it's helping them, it is helping to some placebo effect degree,
yeah.
Right?
And is that inherently good or bad? No. I think that's fine. And especially if it gets them to do what you want. So in this case, if we're talking about relaxation, I can't tell you how many times when I was working at ETSU where we'd have like track and field or volleyball or some team would come in, they'd do a super hard training and I would say, okay, just go chill out, you know, go to the cafeteria, have a meal, or just go chill out for an hour. And what do? They want to run around and play touch butt and like chase tail and do whatever. And they're just being physically
active.
Are
playing touch butt and chasing tail different things?
You know, the guys play touch butt and then they chase tail with the girls.
Okay.
You know, so it's just like getting them to relax is what I want, right? Is there a way, if I just go say, okay, you damn kids, like go relax, they're going to be like, whatever, coach, I'm going to go do whatever I want. If you say like, okay, go like take a hot bath in the AT's office, they'll be like, well, okay, kind of kinky, sounds fun. They'll just do it, right? So that's kind of like, I think that's where like the art of coaching comes in. There's like a science to training and then there's kind of this like art to coaching.
Most coaching is just lying.
Well,
you're just lying to people.
It's like
you're
raising
manipulating,
kids, right?
Lying and tricking people into doing what you want.
I think that goes a long way. So even if there's a placebo effect, if it gets them to do what you want, I think that's great. And I think a relaxation is a really good example of that, where people will say like, oh, like doing, you know, meditation, that's lame. Doing like breathing techniques, that's for sissies. That's stupid. Why would you do that? It doesn't have an effect. Well, what is the effect? The effect's probably relaxation, which is a good effect. And it might not, like doing yoga or breathing or all this or kumbaya stuff might not actually have an independent effect on its own, but it gets them to do what you want, right? It's a means to an end. So if they're willing to do that, they do it for you, even if it's a little placebo action, you still get the desired effect. And I think that's probably more important than anything else. So I think people who are too quick to judge, right, are going to look foolish when their athletes aren't doing what you want them to do. You know what I mean?
For sure. So we know eating is good. We know sleeping is good. We know relaxation / compassionate touching are good.
Well, that one always comes back
around.
It's
impossible. Yeah. And you, even you, Mr. Professional Recovery Guy, still giggles every time it's said.
It's a weird one. You know what's really funny about compassionate touch? The
nothing.
More I look into it, nothing. It's exclusively
serious
horrible.
Business.
The really funny thing about that, the more you read into it, it's another one that's confounded. And so compassionate touch, you know, there's an element to relaxation there. So like even if we went to go get a massage, right? You're lying face down, unwinding. That's relaxation, right? But there's also this weird psychological effect of massage. And the more I read into it, the more it seems to suggest that the benefit of massage, you like the seamless. I'm really good. I'm like Rick from Rick and Morty. The benefit seems to be mostly a psychological one, where just knowing that somebody gives a shit about you enough to like touch you, where you have that close of a relationship, whether it's family, loved one, even a coach, right? You have that intimate of a relationship.
I think USA Gymnastics has been having a big problem with that.
Yeah, I know. There's like there's a boundary there, obviously.
Hashtag safe sport.
But that seems to be like a big confounder. And one of the consistent things that has been said about like massage and compassionate touch is they can't really differentiate the therapy from what they call the therapist, the person just knowing that there's somebody out there who cares about you. And there seems to be a very strong psychosocial aspect to that. And most of the physiological measures that they've looked at for compassionate touch, massage, and the like, there doesn't seem to be much of a physical effect, if at all, there. It's inconsistent at best and probably not trending towards no major physical effects, but the perceptive effects are very, very strong. So it's one of those, like, I think exercise physiologists, including myself for a period of time, were quick to judge and be like, you know, a lot of stuff on massage came out and we're like, that's dumb, it doesn't do anything. But then you're also like neglecting the whole psychological side of recovery too, which I think is also important.
If you get someone to massage you who you don't like, does it work better or worse?
That I'm not sure. I
would think worse from the standpoint of like, oh, I don't like this person, I don't want them touching me. But you could spin it and be like, almost to like a dominance, like
I'm waiting into some S&M kind of stuff. I think like in that case, it would prevent you from fully relaxing, which is probably the big benefit, you know, because now you're like tense. You're like, oh, this guy's touching me. I don't like her. Callousy hands, something like that. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, I you make some good points. And I think compassion, what were we even talking about? I feel like we just rambled on about compassionate touch for a while.
It's just a really important topic.
We lost track of what I was even talking about. Established what is good: nutrition, sleeping,
yes,
relaxation via multiple means. We know that being hot for too long and becoming dehydrated is a bad thing. We know doing excessive, you know, adding extra stretching. I think this is a common culprit. Stretching, mobility work is when it takes away from the energy to train, or could be better spent relaxing. Because no one is relaxing by rolling around in a foam roller, and that stuff hurts.
You know, the ROMWAD kind of stuff, and I'm not trying to like crap on anybody or any particular group or anything, but if you're doing flexibility and mobility stuff for recovery purposes, you're largely just kind of wasting your time. It doesn't really seem to have any big benefit, and it's not enough to be like active recovery, which some people think it is, where it's like, oh, I'm doing an active recovery. Well, it's like, you're actually, it's not enough to be active recovery in that case. You're really just kind of not doing much. And there's some limited evidence that kind of suggests that there could be a blunting effect similar to what we see with like ice and compression from doing a lot of stretching outside of what you need. That's not entirely clear, but there are some potential negative side effects of doing too much stretching. Like, it can actually increase your risk of injury in some cases. It can decrease your force and power output in some cases. It's largely a big waste. And then the better question, like as an exercise physiologist and a coach, is like, why am I adding stuff? What is this doing for my training program? Can that time be better spent doing more training or spending time recovering from that hard training? And I would say probably...
Yeah, where you get kind of caught in a gray area, middle ground between training and recovering.
That's the worst area to be, because now you're doing stuff that adds fatigue but doesn't actually aid in recovery at all. So you're just making it worse.
Do you feel like the people, because people don't have a great grasp on what exactly they're trying to accomplish through recovery modalities?
Yes.
There's not an intent of like, I'm going to, you know, my attempts in doing this particular activity, you know, resting, eating, whatever it is to, you know, decay fatigue in this situation. That's the purpose of this recovery. It almost seems like maybe people are focused, they don't understand what it is, but recovery is like a
buzzword.
It's a thing you do after training that makes you, you know.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. I totally agree. And I like, again, like, we're not trying to like say don't do flexibility, right, don't do mobility. That's certainly a part of most sport training programs, and for good reason. But what we're also saying is, you know, there's a purpose to doing recovery stuff. And the way that I like to think of it, and it might be oversimplified, but it really helps me when I'm looking at stuff and trying to be critical, is I ask the question, does this thing, whatever it is, does it take fatigue away or does it add fatigue?
Right.
That's a really easy way of kind of a preliminary discussion on how we start figuring some of this stuff out. So if the immediate answer is like, well, this adds fatigue, it's most likely not worth your time. It might even be a net negative. Now you can go back and say like, what about active recovery? If you're doing active recovery, you said that's good, but you have to put energy in, right? You have to actually do something. And that is true. But what we see is a very big net positive from doing active recovery, where you put a little bit of energy in. So it does generate a little bit of fatigue, but the amount of recovery that you get, the amount of fatigue that's alleviated afterwards is huge. So there's a net positive there. If you're just doing something that adds fatigue and doesn't take anything away, that's net negative.
Can you give a good example of active recovery for, you know, like a strength sport, powerlifting or weightlifting, just for asking for a friend?
Yeah, totally. So like for powerlifting is probably the easiest example, right? So like, let's say your lifter or yourself is doing something like a 5x5 type program, not the actual program, but that kind of set and rep scheme for your main lifts, right? You're doing like 5 sets of 5, pretty normal. You can take a light day, which is a really good form of active recovery. And a light day is really easy. All you do, instead of doing 5x5, you come in, you do the exact same stuff that you would do. So your squats, your bench, your clean deadlift, any of the techniques that you were doing throughout that mesocycle, nothing new, just the same techniques you were doing in that mesocycle, come in, do 2 sets of 5. And you'll shrug it off and you'll be like, man, that seemed like nothing. And it really is. It's like nothing.
How much would you be looking to reduce intensity at that?
You can either maintain the intensity depending on if the person's like really beat up, or if they're just kind of, it's like a pre-planned light day and they're like, I'm okay. You can just maintain the intensity of whatever they were doing like for that week. Or if it's more of an impromptu light day where they're like, Chad or coach, I'm like, I'm really dying here. You might reduce the relative intensity by about 15% or so.
I think that important thing to note within that idea too is using these light days or technique days is that the more advanced an athlete becomes, the greater modulation from heavy to medium to light sessions that they would need is like, you know, let's say if I was at my strongest and I did 5x5 at 320 kilos, to come back as a recovery means and do 2x5 at 320 would not be decaying fatigue at all. Because I've done it during a peaking phase where my primary deadlift day would be on a Monday and primary squat day would be on a Friday. But all the days in between, I would squat and deadlift, but it would be very, very light, like 170 kilos, you know, but I mean, like 25%, and just very focused on technique, maybe doing 20 or so total reps, whether that in sets of kind of 2 and 3 is just very focused technical things. But I think that's what important to keep in mind of that technical work as being such a useful recovery tool, because something that becomes more and more popular are these EMS devices, Compex, PowerDot, all this stuff. And I get asked about them a lot at seminars. And if I have the option to do, you know, like my quads are very sore from squat workout, I can the next day go in and do Compex, you know, active recovery setting on my quads, or very light squatting.
Damn it. You beat me to like one of my favorite points. So like, I love where you're going. The thing is, like, so doing the light session, whether it's like a recovery specific session where you really take the intensity down, or if it's just a light session where you kind of in the ballpark intensity, you're still within the realm of specificity for whatever activity that you're doing, because you're doing this exact same movements that you normally would do. So we're going to see a direct benefit there of still maintaining the specificity. And like, didn't you sign up for powerlifting or for weightlifting? Isn't this what you like? Don't you want to work on refining those skills? It seems odd to me, and I'm not trying to be like a jerk about it, but it seems odd to me that you would sign up for a sport and then want to like sit on the couch and be zapped, you know, by a machine, which could be cool in like a compassionate touch setting, but
robots aren't compassionate.
I saw that 2019 Compex is actually releasing a compassionate touch robot.
Ooh.
Recovery robot.
Is it like,
it's the Compex is just actually has a hand hand now where the electrodes go, and you just stick it on
like
your body
home from a hard day, like you got your gym bag and you're like, oh thank god, you get on the couch and you put it like on your face and it's like touching you. And then you're like, I don't know, it just seems silly to me. It was like, and you know, for sometimes we get stuck on like the strength examples, and I'm guilty of that. But for other sports, this idea is also applicable. So if you play like soccer or basketball or rugby, don't you want to like practice those same skills, refine those same skills that you need to be successful in any way?
I think it's a lot easier too for the team sport or, you know, field sport athletes to understand their greater need for technique, where powerlifters tend to almost compartmentalize those a lot more, is like, yeah, you know, training for technique, for strength and recovery. But yeah, so hopefully I know where you're going with this, that I could use the compex or I could do the very light training. Both of them are going to promote blood flow into the muscles that are sore. One of them is going to give some degree of at least maintaining technique, if not further developing it.
Yes.
And, you know, for a basketball player, you can control like the intensity of, you know, if they're playing 5-on-5 full court versus just half court stuff, would be, you know, a light session comparatively, because it's going to be less running involved. You can kind of just do drills at a tempoed pace.
Yes.
And develop those skills. You know, they can snatch and clean and jerk, light weights, no hook, no feet, whatever it is, where the intensity and the fatigue generated is going to be reduced, but still technical learning is moving forward.
Absolutely. I've been looking into the eSTEM stuff, and eSTEM is great in the world of injury management, right? It's for awesome, sure, for people who are rebounding from injuries and they're dealing with chronic pain. The question then became like, well, if it helps with that, should it therefore also help with recovering from training? And so far, at least from what I have found, the evidence seems to be like on the very, very tit for tat, but it seems to be trending towards good in terms of promoting recovery. But the only real benefit seems to just be the activation of the muscle tissue, mm-hmm, which then just automatically redirects blood flow to that tissue. So there was, I think there was one study that basically compared eSTEM versus doing some active recovery, and the active recovery that they did, I don't remember exactly what it was, but I want to say it was like cycling or something like kind of lame. And they said, okay, well, compared to that, eSTEM was very comparable to active recovery. And I don't personally think
that's true. But if it was active recovery for a cyclist, it would have been a different...
Yeah. Right.
Something, the technical learning could not be measured in that kind of
situation. Yes, and that's situation. And that's something that we can't quantify, at least right now. So it's one of those things where you might read the abstract and you say, oh, active recovery is just as good or very close to being as good as eSTEM, so why don't I just do the eSTEM? Well, it's like, well, there's a lot more to it. There's like sports skills and tactics that we're not addressing. And in my personal opinion, I don't think it's as good as active recovery. Active recovery is something that we've beaten to death as being very useful. So eSTEM, I think, is kind of a cool toy right now. It's like, check out this cool thing. Does it really enhance recovery? I would say like a regretful yes, but I think it's maybe not the best use of people's time and money, at least for now. And you know what? I will eat a big old slice of Chad Wesley humble pie if somebody says, you know, hey, we came out with a meta-analysis and a systematic review, and turns out eSTEM was this like diamond in the rough, hidden gem that we all missed. And, you know, I'll go back later and say, you know, I missed it and I was wrong, but I just don't think it's going to be like that.
So we've gotten a ton of great information today from Dr. Hoffman. You've got your recovery book coming out.
Yeah, it's going to be great. We're editing it right now.
Gave a lot of preview kind of what to expect, but what can we expect from it? When can we expect it?
We're hoping to get it released out during December, so very soon. We're kind of in the last stages of editing, so hopefully we'll have it out before Christmas. And what to expect? You know, for me, I think what a lot of people we'll see in the recovery book is like, man, I've been looking at all the wrong stuff, when really I should have been looking at what I've already been doing. Have I been managing my lifestyle to match the rigors of training? And usually what we find is the answer is no. So we, in the recovery book, we're going to have a nice kind of roadmap to recovery, where we say we're going to introduce a ton of resources. We're going to have kind of a hierarchy of which ones are really important and which ones are maybe less important. And then we have a nice kind of like flow of like, okay, when you're starting the road to recovery, what are the things that we need to start off with? What are things that we can plan in advance? What are things that we kind of deal with along the way? And then what are some audibles we can pull when things aren't going our way?
Fantastic. All right. This was the Jug Life Podcast. We really appreciate your support, watching, listening, whatever means you do that through. You can find us on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, the iHeartRadio app, and at thejuglife.com. And if you like the podcast, go ahead and give us a review, and maybe you'll get something like this review.
A compassionate touch from CWS himself.
I can't mail that. I can't mail those through. Like this review from Big Marv 333. He says,
Big Marv,
seriously entertaining and superbly informative. Watching their YouTube and listening to their podcast has changed my views on the science of strength training. Follow them out of the realms of bro science and bring your knowledge of strength and muscle building into the modern era. Keep up the great work. And if we're ever in New Orleans, we got to look up Big Marv.
That makes me think of Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Or like, right. Tell him Big Marv.
So Big Marv 333, thank you for the review. Send me an email, chat@jtsstrength.com, and I'll send you a t-shirt or something. And if you like The Jug Life, go on iTunes, give us a 5-star review, write us something funny, and maybe we'll read it here on the air. If you're interested in online coaching, we offer that for powerlifting, weightlifting, and super total. That's the combination of powerlifting and weightlifting through juggernautcoaching.com. Multiple different levels of kind of involvement on your end are available. So we've got something right for pretty much everyone from beginners to the most elite of athletes. We're very proud of the content we produce here on YouTube, thanks to the world's strongest videographer, Shorty Sedang. And go ahead and subscribe to the channel and stay on the lookout. We're usually releasing 2-3 videos a week. So trying to keep it a nice mix of powerlifting, weightlifting, other nutrition, movement, mobility type of things. So stay on the lookout for that. James, where can they find you?
Renaissance Periodization. I have a crappy Facebook where I post things about death metal and cats, and I get like 5 sympathy likes. So that's cool. Instagram, but mostly renaissanceperiodization.com.
Is RP Dr. James?
RP Dr. James on Instagram, and just James Hoffman on Facebook. Not even the James Hoffman, just James Hoffman.
The real James Hoffman?
The real.
No.
Maybe the real James Hoffman.
Location, Hoffmanistan.
Not Max Ada.
You can find me max_8 on Instagram or Facebook, or if you have any questions about the online coaching, go ahead and email me max@jtsstrength.com.
And I'm Chad Wilsley Smith, @ChadWilsleySmith and @JuggernautTrain on Facebook and Instagram, filling up your newsfeed all day. This episode was brought to you by IPAs and Fatigue Decay.
Oh,
I forgot to say it at the start. Hopefully they
that was good.
Hopefully they stuck around to the very end.
Yeah. I assume everyone watches all the way to the end.
Till the next time, thank you for watching.